A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's heavy. He's been renting in Israel for a decade, same as his wife Hannah. They're actually leaving their current apartment right now, because the landlord ended the tenancy after being asked when repairs might happen. That's the trigger. And he's looking at this whole system, what he calls a jungle, and asking two things. First, how would you even go about gathering the war stories, the tenant experiences that never make it to media, and turning that into something policymakers can't ignore? And second, if someone actually founded a nonprofit to push for real tenancy reform, what kind of pushback would they face? Defamation suits, landlord lobbies, the whole machinery. What's it actually like on the front lines of social reform in Israel?
The first thing to understand is that Israel's rental market is structurally unusual in ways that make tenant protection almost impossible before you even get to politics. The Fair Rental Law passed in 2017, and it was the first serious attempt at reform. Before that, there was basically nothing. The law introduced a few things: a requirement for written contracts, a repair obligation timeline, some limits on eviction without cause. It failed spectacularly. And the reason it failed tells you everything about why gathering those war stories matters. The law didn't create a rental registry. There's no enforcement mechanism, no agency, no tribunal, no inspector. So landlords ignore it, tenants don't know their rights exist, and even if they do know, the cost of pursuing a claim in court exceeds the value of almost any rental dispute. You'd spend 15,000 shekels on legal fees to recover 3,000 shekels in overcharged rent. The math doesn't work.
The reform was the legislative equivalent of putting a sign on a bear that says "Do not maul" and calling it wildlife management.
And the bear can't read.
Bears famously illiterate. So, if you wanted to gather these stories, the war stories, you're not just collecting anecdotes for a newsletter, you're building the evidentiary foundation that the 2017 law never had. Because without data, the policy conversation stays abstract. Landlords say the market works fine, tenants are happy, here's a survey of property owners, and nobody can point to anything systematic to push back.
And the thing about tenancy at will, which is the default in Israel, is that it creates a permanent asymmetry. The landlord can end the lease with 30 days' notice for almost any reason, or no reason. The tenant has no security of tenure. You can't plan your life around a home that could disappear next month. You can't put your kid in a school district with confidence. You can't invest in your community. And the psychological effect of that, the constant precarity, is something that doesn't show up in any government statistic.
Which is why the first question, how do you gather this material, is actually a research design problem, disguised as an advocacy problem. You need methodology. You can't just collect horror stories on a Facebook group and call it evidence. That's what the landlord lobby expects you to do, and they'll dismiss it as unrepresentative grievance.
Let me walk through what a serious data gathering effort would look like. First, you design a structured survey. Not just tell us your worst experience, but specific questions. How long was your lease? Did you have a written contract? Were repairs completed within the legal time frame? Did you experience a rent increase above the index? Were you evicted without cause? Did you know your rights under the 2017 law? Did you attempt to enforce them? What happened when you did?
Standardized questions let you aggregate. You can say 37% of respondents reported repairs not completed within 30 days. Not this one guy I know had a leaky ceiling for 6 months.
And you'd want to partner with an academic institution for credibility. The Taub Center, the Hebrew University Sociology Department, someone who can lend methodological weight and publish peer-reviewed findings. Because, when you eventually sit down with a Knesset committee, you don't want them asking who conducted this research and having to say a Facebook group.
The other piece is sampling. Israel's rental market splits along demographic lines that matter. Arab renters, Haredi renters, young couples, students, olim, foreign workers. If your survey only captures secular Tel Aviv professionals, you've missed the populations most vulnerable to exploitation. You need Arabic language versions, Russian, Amharic. You need distribution through community centers and social services, not just Twitter.
This is where the war stories become powerful in a different way. Quantitative data gets you in the door. But when you're testifying, when you're meeting with MKs, you lead with the numbers and then you put a face on them. Here's a single mother in Be'er Sheva whose landlord cut off the water when she complained about mold. Here's a family in Haifa that moved 4 times in 3 years because every lease got terminated when they asked for basic maintenance. The numbers frame the scale. The story makes it human.
There's a trap here, though. The story that gets told is often the most extreme one, and the opposition will seize on that. They'll say you're cherry-picking the worst cases, that most rentals are fine, that landlords are small investors, not corporations. And in Israel, that last part is actually true in a way that complicates the narrative.
Something like 80% of rental properties in Israel are owned by individual investors, not companies. The landlord is in Blackstone. It's a couple in their 60s who bought an apartment as their pension. And when you propose reforms, they show up to Knesset hearings too, and their story is, I worked my whole life, I bought this property, and now you're telling me I can't decide who lives in it.
Which means the data gathering has to anticipate that counter-narrative and account for it. You don't just document tenant harm. You also document what functional rental markets look like in comparable countries, what protections exist, and crucially, what the actual economic impact on landlords has been. Because in Germany, in the Netherlands, in places with strong tenant protections, small landlords still exist. The market didn't collapse. The pension apartment didn't become worthless.
Germany has indefinite leases by default. The landlord can only terminate for specific reasons, own use, major renovation, breach of contract. And the small landlord market functions. The sky didn't fall. So part of the research is comparative, bringing in evidence from jurisdictions that have already done what you're proposing, so the doomsday predictions can be met with actual data.
That leads into the second question, which is the pushback. Because if you're founding a nonprofit to do this work, the pushback isn't going to be polite disagreement over policy details. It's going to be organized, well-funded, and personal.
The landlord lobby in Israel is real and it's effective. The Israel Builders Association, the Real Estate Appraisers Association, various property owner groups. They have relationships with MKs. They show up to committee hearings. They run op-eds. And their core argument is simple. Any restriction on landlords reduces the rental supply, which raises rents, which hurts tenants. It's the same argument you hear everywhere, and it's not entirely wrong in the short term, which makes it hard to dismiss.
It's the supply side trap. If you make it harder to evict, fewer people rent out their properties, supply drops, prices rise, and the very tenants you're trying to help are worse off. That's the argument. And in a market as tight as Israel's, with housing construction chronically lagging population growth, it lands.
The counter-argument, and this is where your data becomes essential, is that security of tenure changes the demand side too. When tenants have stability, they stay longer. Turnover costs drop. Landlords spend less on finding new tenants, less on vacancy periods. And tenants invest in the property, maintain it better, treat it more like a home. The German model shows this. Long-term tenancy creates value for both sides.
The pushback goes beyond lobbying. The prompt specifically mentions defamation law, and this is not theoretical. Israel's defamation law is genuinely aggressive. You can sue for defamation without proving damages. The burden of proof is on the defendant, and the law was amended in 2020 to allow courts to award up to 75,000 shekels without proof of damages, which doubled the previous cap.
Here's the thing about defamation law in the context of tenant advocacy. If you start naming landlords, publishing testimonials about specific properties or specific people, you are walking into a legal minefield. Even if everything you publish is true, the cost of defending a defamation suit can bankrupt a small nonprofit before you ever get to a verdict. The case drags on for 2 years, your legal bills hit 6 figures, and the landlord doesn't even need to win. They just need to make you bleed.
This is the SLAP playbook. Strategic lawsuit against public participation. The goal isn't to win in court. The goal is to exhaust your resources and scare everyone else into silence, and Israel has no anti-SLAPP legislation. There's no mechanism for early dismissal of frivolous defamation suits aimed at silencing advocacy. You're fully exposed.
If you're building this nonprofit, you need legal counsel from day one. Not when you get sued, before you publish anything. Every testimonial needs to be vetted. You need consent forms from tenants. You need to understand what constitutes opinion versus fact under Israeli defamation law. Opinion is protected. Saying this landlord was negligent is an opinion. Saying this landlord failed to repair a leak for 6 months is a factual claim. You need evidence for the latter.
Even with all that, you're going to get sued. Or threatened with suit. The question is whether you've structured the organization to survive it. That means a legal defense fund, pro bono relationships with law firms, and a communication strategy that doesn't crumble the moment a cease and desist letter arrives.
There's a broader point here about what it's actually like on the front lines of social reform. People imagine it's about rallies and viral campaigns and dramatic Knesset testimony. It's not. It's mostly about document review. It's about sitting in meetings with lawyers going over every sentence you want to publish. It's about spending 60% of your time on compliance and risk management and 40% on the actual advocacy.
It's lonely. That's the part nobody talks about. When you're pushing against a system that benefits powerful people, you lose friends. You get uninvited from things. People who agree with you privately won't say so publicly because they have business relationships with developers, or they're renting from someone connected, or they just don't want the hassle. You learn quickly who actually has your back.
The other thing is that reform takes forever. The 2017 law took years of advocacy, and it produced something toothless. If you're starting now, you're looking at a 5 to 10 year horizon before anything meaningful passes, and that's optimistic. You need institutional patience, and you need to structure the organization so it can survive leadership, turnover, burnout, funding droughts.
Funding is its own problem. If you're a tenant advocacy nonprofit in Israel, who funds you? Not the government. They're not going to fund an organization whose entire purpose is to pressure the government. Foundations maybe, but Israeli philanthropy tends towards security, education, health. Tenant rights is not a glamorous cause. You're competing with cancer charities.
There are some models, though. The Association for Civil Rights in Israel has done housing work. Yedid, the community empowerment organization, runs tenant rights centers in low-income communities. Shatil provides capacity building for social change organizations, so the infrastructure exists. You wouldn't be starting from absolute zero. But none of these organizations have made tenancy reform their primary mission.
Which is the gap. And it's a weird gap because housing affects everyone. It's not a niche issue. It's the single largest expense for most households. It determines where your kids go to school, how long your commute is, whether you can stay near aging parents. It's foundational. And yet tenant advocacy in Israel is fragmented, underfunded, and politically orphaned.
Part of that is because renters don't vote as a bloc. They're older, more established, more likely to show up in municipal and national elections. Renters are younger, more transient, less politically organized. So politicians respond to the constituency that actually turns out. It's not a conspiracy, it's just political gravity.
That's starting to shift. The housing crisis has gotten so bad that even middle-class families are stuck renting indefinitely. The old assumption that you rent in your 20s and buy in your 30s has broken down for a huge chunk of the population. That changes the political calculus. Eventually, the renter bloc gets big enough and angry enough that someone campaigns on it.
That's where your war stories archive becomes politically potent. If you've documented thousands of cases across every demographic in every region, you can hand a Knesset member a district-by-district breakdown. Here's how many of your constituents are affected. Here's what they're experiencing. Here's what they want. That's how you turn stories into power.
Let me push on something, though. The prompt frames this as a civil rights issue, and I think that's correct, but it also raises the stakes in a way that invites harder pushback. If you frame tenancy reform as a fundamental right, you're not just asking for better contract terms, you're challenging property rights, which in Israel have a particular legal and ideological weight.
The basic law on human dignity and liberty protects property rights. The courts have interpreted this broadly. Any law that significantly restricts a landlord's ability to use their property as they see fit faces a potential constitutional challenge. So your reform has to be carefully designed to survive judicial review. You're not just negotiating with Knesset members, you're drafting for a future Supreme Court case.
Which means your nonprofit needs constitutional lawyers, not just housing policy people. The team gets expensive fast.
And this is where coalition building matters. You can't do this alone, one scrappy nonprofit against the entire real estate industry. You need allies, tenant unions, if you can organize them, student associations, who represent a huge renter population, labor unions, who have institutional muscle and legal resources, social justice organizations, municipal governments who deal with the fallout of housing instability.
The municipal angle is interesting. Cities have an interest in stable tenancy. They want families in schools, they want consistent utility payments, they want neighborhoods that aren't constantly churning. Some cities, like Tel Aviv, have experimented with affordable housing requirements for new developments. But municipal authority is limited. The real power is at the national level, with the Israel Land Authority and the Knesset.
The ILA controls 93% of Israel's land. That's a state monopoly on land allocation. And the way land is released for development, the terms on which it's leased, the whole system shapes the housing market from the top down. If you're serious about tenant reform, you eventually have to engage with land policy. You can't fix the rental market without understanding why housing supply is so constrained in the first place.
Which is a whole other episode, but it connects to the pushback question, because the interests that benefit from the current land allocation system are not just landlords. They're developers, contractors, municipal planning committees, the whole construction ecosystem. When you start pushing for reform, you discover how many people are making money from things staying exactly as they are.
They're organized. The Israel Builders Association is one of the most powerful lobbying groups in the country. They have full-time government relations staff. They're in the room when housing legislation is drafted. Your scrappy nonprofit is not in that room unless you fight your way in.
To the question of what it's actually like on the front lines, the honest answer is, it's a grind. You're out-resourced, out-lawyered, and out-networked. You win by being more persistent, by having better data, by building broader coalitions, and by waiting for the political moment when the cost of inaction becomes higher than the cost of crossing the landlord lobby.
There's a concept in social movement theory called the political opportunity structure. Basically, change happens when the alignment of public opinion, elite interests, and institutional access creates an opening. Your job as an advocate is to be ready when that opening appears. Have the policy drafted, have the coalition built, have the stories ready, have the legal analysis done. So when a window opens, maybe after an election, maybe after a scandal, maybe after a crisis, you can move.
The other thing is, you have to stay sane while you wait. The prompt asks how you stay strong in the face of these dynamics, and it's not a small question. Burnout in advocacy is real. You're fighting a system that's designed to exhaust you. Every win is partial. Every defeat is demoralizing. The people you're trying to help are sometimes angry at you for not moving fast enough.
The people who last in this work tend to have a few things in common. They celebrate small wins. A committee hearing that went well. A media story that shifted the conversation. A single family that got their deposit back because of your intervention. They don't wait for the big legislative victory to feel like they're making a difference.
They also build community among themselves. The prompt mentions that stories of tenant exploitation are everywhere once you start asking. That's not just data. That's solidarity. Knowing you're not alone in this fight, that other people are experiencing the same thing, that you're part of something larger than your own terrible landlord that sustains people through the hard parts.
There's a practical dimension too. If you're going to be sued, if you're going to be attacked in the press, if you're going to be called a radical or a foreign agent or whatever the smear of the day is, you need a support system that holds. People who will show up to court with you, who will write op-eds defending you, who will remind you why you started this when you want to quit.
The defamation piece deserves one more look because it's the sharpest weapon in the landlord arsenal. Under Israeli law, even a true statement can be defamatory if it was published with intent to harm. That's an unusually broad standard. Most common law jurisdictions, truth is an absolute defense, not in Israel. If the court finds you published something true but with malicious intent, you can still lose.
Malicious intent is a subjective standard. A court can infer it from the tone of your publication, from the timing, from the fact that you published multiple stories about the same landlord. So a pattern of advocacy can be recast as a campaign of harassment. It's a chilling effect baked into the law.
The countermeasure is discipline. Never publish in anger. Never make it personal. Frame everything as systemic analysis. Don't say this landlord is a slumlord. Say this property had 27 documented code violations over 18 months, and here's what the municipal records show. Let the facts do the work. The more boring and bureaucratic your output, the harder it is to paint you as a malicious actor.
Which is counterintuitive for advocacy. You want to be passionate, you want to be compelling, you want to move people. But the legal reality forces a kind of institutional voice that can feel flat. The art is finding ways to communicate urgency and moral weight while staying within the lines that keep you out of court.
The BPC model, essentially. Just report what happened. Let the audience feel what they feel.
And pair that with personal storytelling that comes directly from tenants themselves, in their own words, with their names attached. When a tenant says, "My ceiling collapsed and my children were showered with debris," that's their testimony. The nonprofit is just the platform. The landlord can sue the tenant, but suing a tenant for describing their own living conditions is a terrible look. Most won't do it.
That's the distributed liability strategy. Don't centralize the risk in the organization. Let the stories live on a platform where the speakers retain ownership and responsibility for their own words. It's not a perfect shield, but it helps.
There's one more thing about the front lines experience that doesn't get talked about enough. You will be lied about. Not sued, not debated, just lied about. Someone will claim you're funded by foreign interests trying to undermine Israeli property rights. Someone will claim you're a political operative for whatever party they don't like. Someone will claim you've never paid rent in your life and you're just bitter. None of it will be true and none of that will matter.
You can't spend all your time correcting the record. That's the trap. You spend so much energy responding to smears that you stop doing the actual work. You become a reactive organization instead of a proactive one. The discipline is to document the lies, have a response ready if a journalist asks, and otherwise keep moving.
Some of the most effective social reform organizations in Israeli history have operated with a kind of strategic indifference to personal attacks. They don't take the bait. They stay focused on the policy. They let their work speak. And over time, the people who matter, the MKs, the journalists, the civil servants, learn to distinguish between the noise and the substance.
Which brings us back to the beginning. The War Stories Archive. The data gathering. Because that's the foundation everything else rests on. Without it, you're just another voice in a crowded room. With it, you're the organization that actually knows what's happening on the ground. And that's harder to ignore.
The timing might be right. The housing crisis isn't getting better. Interest rates are high, construction is slow, prices keep climbing. More Israelis are renting longer, and more of them are angry about it. The political opportunity structure is shifting. Someone is going to fill that space. The question is whether it's going to be thoughtful, data-driven, legally sophisticated advocates, or whether it's going to be populists who make promises they can't keep and give up when it gets hard.
The prompt ends with, "What's it actually like on the front lines?" And I think the honest answer is, it's like renting. It's precarious. You don't know if you'll still be doing this in a year. The people with power can end your lease whenever they want. But you do it anyway because someone has to, and because the alternative is accepting that the jungle is permanent.
Sometimes the jungle isn't permanent. The 2017 law, for all its flaws, showed that the issue can move. It created a framework, however weak. The next reform builds on that framework. The one after that builds further. You're not starting from zero, you're starting from a failed first attempt. And failed first attempts are how most successful reforms begin.
To pull it together, if you're building this, start with the data. Partner with an academic institution. Design a rigorous survey. Collect stories systematically. Build the comparative case from jurisdictions that have done this successfully. Get legal counsel before you publish anything. Build a coalition that includes labor, students, municipalities, anyone with a stake in stable housing. Structure for the long haul, which means succession planning, diversified funding, and institutional resilience. Expect defamation threats. Expect smears. Expect the landlord lobby to come at you with everything. Stay disciplined. Stay boring in your public output. Let the tenants tell their own stories. And find your people, because you won't survive this alone. If money falls out of the sky tomorrow and you buy a place, do it anyway. Because the fact that you got out doesn't mean the problem is solved for everyone else.
That's the thing about housing advocacy. The most effective advocates are often people who are no longer personally affected. They have the security to take risks. They have the time to show up. They're harder to intimidate because they're not worried about their own lease. So if you do get out, that's not the end of your involvement. That's when you become more dangerous to the status quo.
And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1920s, French colonial botanists documenting the plant life of Chad's Ennedi Plateau reported a peculiar sundew species that curls its tentacles inward at a speed 5 times faster when capturing prey at night than during daylight hours, a behavioral anomaly never fully explained.
The plant has a night mode, faster reflexes in the dark. That's unsettling.
A carnivorous plant with performance anxiety during the day. I relate to that.
This has been my weird prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you listen. We'll be back next time with another prompt, another deep dive, and another fact that raises more questions than it answers.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.